Radio EcoShock.
If you are not worried about climate change, you don't know, don't want to know, or you're trying hard not to think about it. But experts find millions of people are suffering psychologically. They have climate anxiety or depression or other symptoms that damage lives. In a worried world, Dr. Susan Clayton is busy. She's an acknowledged expert in the field. Clayton helped develop a scale to measure climate anxiety. She publishes assessments for the American Psychological Association and helped cover this growing problem in the latest report by the IPCC on climate change. In Ohio, at the College of Worcester, Clayton is a social and environmental psychologist. She's also a visiting fellow at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Paris. From Ohio, Susan Clayton, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for the invitation. It's good to be with you.
The Center for Disease Control just issued a serious warning about deteriorating mental health in American teens. The CDC said, quote, "In 2021, more than 4 in 10 students felt persistently sad or hopeless," end quote. One child in 10 attempted suicide, they say. Susan, this is terrible. The pandemic did not help. But is climate anxiety part of it? And how would you know that?
Well, I would say it's definitely part of it. And we know that really for several reasons. One is just what people say and what young people say. They are talking about it. The second is surveys that are done often with nationally representative samples that show really high levels of worry about climate change and about the way climate change is going to impact people's personal lives. And then third is some of the research that you mentioned that I'm involved in that other people have also been doing that links anxiety and concern about climate change with established clinical measures of anxiety and depression.
Is climate anxiety a generational thing, or are older people affected as well?
Older people are definitely affected as well, and we definitely see, particularly in Western countries, that younger adults are experiencing it at higher levels, and that's not surprising if you think about it. They are the ones who are really going to be facing the problem in a way that's much less true for people who are already, you know, middle-aged or beyond. Younger generations have also grown up with an awareness of climate change, which I don't think it certainly wasn't true for me, except it maybe a vague sense that somebody was talking about that, but I don't remember really worrying about it until 20 years ago or so. So yes, younger people tend to experience it more, but we're definitely seeing it in older generations, and in some countries it may actually be stronger in the older generation. So it's not certainly not just confined to younger adults.
Could you describe the kind of symptoms we might see in a person suffering from climate-related distress?
Absolutely. And I want to take this moment first to just say, you know, being worried about climate change doesn't mean that you have a mental illness by any means. It's a rational response. In some ways, it's even a functional response because anxiety serves as kind of an internal warning signal to say something's going on here and we need to pay attention and we may need to respond to it. It definitely should not be considered problematic to worry about climate change, if anything, the reverse. However, there certainly are people whose worry is so powerful that it seems to be interfering with their ability to function at some level, and that's when we start to think of it as a problem for mental health, a clinical problem. And some of the symptoms that you might see are people report having trouble sleeping, or they feel like they just think about climate change all the time. They can't stop thinking about it. Maybe they cry. They have nightmares. They can't concentrate. They feel that they can't just enjoy themselves. They can't just take time off to enjoy with their friends or family because they feel like they need to be focusing on climate change. For those people, I think it does begin to threaten mental health, and they can benefit from getting help in coping.
The World Health Organization has named mental health as a priority in climate risk and response. Why does this matter so much on a global scale?
It matters for several reasons, depending on your perspective. One is that if we think about the impacts of climate change solely to those people who are experiencing them directly, so, for example, maybe you are experiencing wildfires or flooding from an extreme storm or something like that, those are terrible experiences, but that's a far smaller number of people than the number of people who are aware of climate change and thinking about climate change. So if we are fully thinking about how many people are affected, those mental health impacts of climate change awareness are important to consider. And then a second reason is that I think it makes it easier for people to understand how they themselves might be affected. So it makes it more real and present than just thinking about climate change as something that's going to affect other people.
My studio is in British Columbia, Canada. My wife and I lived through the record-smashing heat dome in 2021, and that was after the wildfires had burned half the area around us in a couple of years before. We used to love summer, but now my wife dreads it. We have a bug-out bag packed by the door as the season arrives. You did a study on the 2021 heat dome in BC. What did you find?
This is, from a research point of view, fortuitous, although, of course, it was a frightening event. Some data had been collected using social media just before the heat dome that asked people about their level of climate anxiety. So after the heat dome happened, the people collecting the data were able to pivot and very quickly collect some more data, and we did see that there had been a significant increase in climate anxiety based on that experience of the heat dome.
Well, as you say, it could be floods or huge storms or fires or just unrelenting killer heat, but when the disaster is over, when it moves on, are the mental health effects self-healing? Do people get over it fairly quickly?
Not necessarily by any means. Some of the effects might, in fact, not even be apparent until a little bit later. So immediately after something like a wildfire or a storm, people might feel relieved and grateful and happy that they survived. And then it's only as the magnitude of the impact become clear to them that they start experiencing the mental health consequences. So there have been a number of studies that find that you find increased rates of mental health problems a few months, even a year or more after the event.
Susan, when in your career did you become aware of the psychological threat rising along with climate change?
Yeah, I wish I could say that I had sort of very insightfully thought about it all on my own and come up with the idea all by myself, but that wasn't really true. I had already been studying the ways in which people kind of relate to the natural world and why it's important to them and their sense of who they are. So I began to think or to realize just from listening to people that if the natural environment is important to you, then changes in that environment might have an impact on you. But I was really prompted to look at that issue more deeply by two things. One is a task force that the American Psychological Association put together back in the 2008, 2009, somewhere around then. And then a few years later, I was asked by the nonprofit EcoAmerica to spearhead essentially a report that talked about evidence for impacts of climate change on mental health. And what I found was that there was a lot of evidence, but to my knowledge, nobody had yet, you know, put it together at that point and said, yes, climate change has an effect on mental health. So it was very new, but we already knew that it was going to be a big factor.
In the early years, there was some denial among psychologists and psychiatrists even. They said climate fears were overblown or imaginary. Earlier on, did you feel like an outlier, even among psychologists, and is that changing?
Yes and yes. And I should say that I'm actually not a mental health professional per se. I'm trained as a research social psychologist, so looking into mental health itself was a little bit of a new for me, and I define mental health very broadly to include well-being and maybe social interactions, so it's not just about post-traumatic stress disorder. Fairly early on in my career, I and a few other people who were interested in the natural environment really struggled to get psychologists to pay attention, and of course there were exceptions, but it was not the norm, and I had multiple psychologists say to me, you know, what does psychology have to do with environmental issues? Ironically, I think that the broader public and people interested in environmental health and conservation were more receptive to the idea of psychology than psychologists were receptive to the idea of focusing on conservation. That's definitely changed, and I think it's a kind of chicken and the egg problem. I don't know which came first, but certainly a lot of clinical psychologists and other mental health professionals are thinking about the effects of climate change, and many of them say their clients are talking to them about climate change-related anxieties and distress. So there's just so much more awareness than there was even 5 years ago.
With your Worcester colleague, Brian Carazio, you developed a climate anxiety scale. It has been tested and validated in several countries. I noticed studies coming out of Poland and Germany. What is the tool for, and who should use it?
Well, again, sometimes there will be a cutoff score that says if you score above this level, then you're, you know, considered to have a disorder. We did not design it for that reason. But we did design it because people were beginning to talk about climate anxiety as if it were a clinical issue, but nobody had yet demonstrated that. So we really wanted to see, can we find a measure that will be reliable as a measure? And basically that was one goal. And then the second goal is to see whether there were these clinical ramifications, whether it was associated with other signs of kind of mental distress.
Susan, do you think millions of people could become so anxious or depressed to the point they cannot react to obvious climate damage? Is climate change almost disabling the ability to respond to climate change?
Well, it certainly could happen. I don't think it will. At any point, people could fall into despair for a number of reasons, but usually people are remarkably resilient overall. So most people survive really horrific things and are still able to function. So that's one reason I say it's unlikely. Another is that I think part of the climate anxiety is linked to a perception that nobody's doing anything about it. And certainly in one study I was involved in where we looked at people worldwide, young people worldwide, they reported really high levels of pessimism about, they felt that their governments were not doing anything about it. They felt that people were ignoring them or dismissing their concerns. So that by itself can contribute to that feeling of anxiety and despair. As a society, I think we are increasingly acknowledging that climate change is real, even though there's still quite a lot of disagreement about what to do about it. But at least we know that other people are paying attention, and that sense that, okay, we're facing something difficult, it's not as bad if you think, nevertheless, there are governmental agencies designed to look into how to respond. There are nonprofits coming together. There's educational initiatives. There's community support. So climate change is the problem, but there are lots of things we can do to alleviate climate anxiety, even without solving climate change.
Radio EcoShock does go out over some college stations, and I sometimes worry by communicating the awful scientific truth, are we just hurting the mental health of young people? Can we communicate climate information safely?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's one I think a lot of educators are worried about, and a lot of parents even, who report in some cases that they don't want to bring up the topic with their children because they're afraid that it will, you know, harm the child's mental health. And I'll say two very general things. One is that you don't want to hide things from people. That's not going to be the answer, especially for a parent, but also for an educator or, you know, an informational radio broadcast. But a second thing is certainly that there are better and worse ways to convey that information, and you want to be aware of the group you're speaking to. So for very young children, you wouldn't want to give them too scary of a message. For college students and for adults in general, I think you can emphasize the threat, but it's also important to not make people feel hopeless. And so including some information about here are some hopeful signs, here's a new technology that's being developed, or here's a new policy that's being rolled out. So just to balance out, there's a threat, but we're not despairing, we're not giving up.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from the College of Worcester. We are speaking with Professor and Psychologist Susan Clayton about climate and mental health. Susan, can we protect our mental health without denial or dodging reality?
I think so. And in fact, in the long run, denial is usually not a good strategy. You know, of course, it works in the short term, which is why we do it. To deny there's a problem, we don't have to think about it. But it becomes increasingly difficult to maintain that denial in the face of reality. So things we can do include, as I sort of just mentioned, finding reasons for optimism or for hope, but also some very specific things we can do for ourselves. And one is, in some cases, actually getting more information. So you mentioned the possibility that more information can actually lead people to be more anxious, which is true if they're not thinking about it at all. But sometimes the anxieties are based on a really apocalyptic vision of the future that's not really grounded in reality. Like, you hear people say things like, the world will be burned up in 20 years, and we're not facing anything like that unless something unexpected happens. So getting more informed can help you cope, especially it makes you feel a little, just understanding what's going on a little bit better gives you a greater feeling of control. Another important thing to do is to connect with other people who share your concerns, because, again, that just makes you feel like you're not alone, and also that there are other people who share your concerns and also your values. And then a third thing would be to try and find some way to take action, and that can be whatever way is comfortable for an individual. But taking action, whether it be by protesting or by changing your own household, you know, purchasing and behaviors, you no longer feel just like a passive victim. You now feel like someone who is taking control of their life in some way. So that can also be a good thing to do. Finally, then a lot of the techniques that are good for mental health in general are going to be good for your mental health in this circumstance. So getting exercise, getting sleep, going for walks, especially in nature, practicing mindfulness in some circumstances, learning maybe how to be in tune with your own emotions. All of those things can be helpful.
Thank you so much for that. I know our listeners will appreciate it. The American Psychiatric Association also has pamphlets online about climate mental health, and as I said, the World Health Organization recently named it as a priority. Tell us about your work with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and what their latest report said about mental health risks of climate.
It's a mixed bag. I was, you know, really happy to be able to work with this group. It's for those listeners who are not very familiar with the work. There's a central organizing committee, but then the reports are written by hundreds of volunteer scientists from around the world. So it is very, very international. It's pretty intensive work, and it is all volunteer. But it was wonderful to work with this group of people coming from such different backgrounds, all committed to trying to understand and alert people to the consequences of climate change. So my experience was very good, and I was especially happy that they were devoting so much attention to mental health, because the previous assessment report, which came out in, I want to say 2017 or 2018, but I may be getting it wrong, made just very brief mention to mental health and didn't go into it in any detail. So this was really a new emphasis for the committee. And what to be very brief about what we describe is that there is very good, very solid evidence that mental health is already being impaired by climate change and reasons to worry about future impacts. However, there are things that can be done to reduce the extent or the likelihood of those impacts.
When you connect with climate scientists, have you noticed identifiable symptoms in them? Are they telling you about anxiety because of what they know?
Well, that is another interesting question, and one that I've definitely seen asked by others. In my experience, I haven't seen this so much, and I think the reason is, it gets back to what I was saying a minute ago, that climate scientists are engaged with the issue, and they are talking to other people who are also engaged with the issue. So those social connections are a really powerful way of avoiding despair and getting meaning from the work, finding meaning in the work you're doing. Now, they are, of course, thinking a lot about climate change, and they're very aware of some of the negative impacts or consequences or predictions associated with climate change. So I would be surprised if there are any climate scientists who don't sometimes feel pessimistic. But in my personal experience, the dominant emotion has been, well, it hasn't been despair. It's been, we've got something to do, let's do it. And, you know, perfectly happy people when you interact with them on an interpersonal basis.
You don't treat individual patients as a psychologist. You're an environmental psychologist and a social psychologist. What does that mean?
Yes, good question. Well, social psychologists essentially try to understand behavior rather than addressing individual distress. So the social psychologists study a huge range of things such as interpersonal behavior, attraction, aggression, prejudice, altruism, and just how people think about social issues. So that's kind of my background there. Environmental psychologists is another very broad field, although not quite as broad as social psychology. It tends to focus on how people are affected by the physical environment rather than by the social environment. And so the physical environment can include things such as lighting or temperature or even, you know, the color of the walls or the arrangement of the furniture. But, you know, recent decades, as opposed to at the very start, there's been an increasing focus on the natural environment and how people are affected by exposure to the natural environment, which is, it's funny that for a long time nobody was really paying attention to that. But we have, again, very good evidence now that natural environments are good for people. They reduce stress, may promote creativity and social relationships. To the extent that some, you know, medical practitioners and certainly public health agencies are suggesting that doctors should prescribe nature for people and tell them, you know, go take a walk in the woods, and that's the way to stay healthy.
You also specialize in the psychology of justice. How does that operate during a climate shift like this?
Oh, I'm really glad you brought that up. One thing that a lot of people aren't aware of, and I think just it makes sense once you start to think about it, but that we're not encouraged to look at this direction, is the incredible inequities in the impacts of climate change. So we think of something like global climate change, we think everybody in the world is going to experience the same effects, but that's very far from being the case. Certainly many places around the world are already experiencing really dire effects that other people are not experiencing. And not coincidentally, the places that are experiencing the worst effects tend to be people that have contributed the least to the problem. So sub-Saharan Africa, for example, experiencing, you know, high levels of drought, low-lying, sort of not economically developed countries, very much threatened by climate change. And even within the U.S., we know, for example, lots of problems in the Gulf of Mexico associated with flooding and with major hurricanes. So there's that inequitable distribution of harms that is linked to some people sort of getting more benefit from natural resources than the others. And those inequitable distribution is very much linked to being a member of a minoritized community or a lower socioeconomic status, because people in those communities traditionally, frequently, have been sort of shunted off into less desirable areas that are more vulnerable to climate impacts. And we really saw that following Hurricane Katrina, I think was a wake-up call for a lot of people about the racial discrepancies in the impact of the hurricane based on how well your community was capable to deal with the effects.
Everybody knows climate is already a disaster and the future looks worse, but oil and gas companies made billions more last quarter. Everybody's buying and flying. It seems we just don't care. Why do you think that is?
Well, I would say it's not at all the case that people don't care. If we focus on trying to get people to care more, we're looking in the wrong direction. I think people very much do care, but in some cases they don't know what to do. In some cases they don't think it's their own responsibility to do something, and they assume someone else will do it. And in some cases, there's a lot of inertia. We tend to keep doing the things we've always been doing, even if they're no longer the right ways of acting given the current circumstances. So I think what we do need is something to shake us out of inertia, and hopefully that will be a good thing, like new governmental policies or new social policies, and not a bad thing like a real environmental disaster that prevents us from doing the things that we normally do.
Well, obviously there are not enough practitioners to treat such large populations, and I presume some kind of social change is needed. What are you and other experts proposing as solutions for better mental health resilience during a climate shift?
A lot of people are working on ways to support new ways to support mental health, and that can mean recognizing that you don't have to kind of wait till you have a problem and then call a therapist any more than you have to wait until you, you know, have a medical problem and call a medical doctor. We can provide people with mental health skills and mental health training in other kinds of ways, like through standard education system or community outreach. And there are also ways to support mental health, again, ahead of time. And one of those, I just have been talking about the positive effects of nature on mental health. So making sure people have access to nature, even the ability to see trees out your window is associated with, you know, being calmer and being in a better mood. So enhancing the kind of green infrastructure of our cities is another way in which we can promote mental health. But really thinking about what are the organizational arrangements and rearrangements and practices that are needed to support mental health at a societal and at a global level.
As we finish our time together, is there anything else you would like to leave with our listeners?
One of the things I hope they walk away with is that we all have the potential to be affected by climate change if we're not already affected, and if not our physical health, our mental health, our economic activities, and so on. But that we're not doomed. We're not doomed, and by attending to the problem, we can find some ways to address it. And addressing it has, in many cases, actual benefits. It's not just avoiding the problem, but doing so in ways that actually might make our lives better.
Our guest, Professor Susan Clayton, is author of many papers, books, and reports on climate anxiety. When not at the College of Worcester in Ohio, Susan is in Paris at the Institute for Advanced Studies. Find links to the papers and reports we talked about in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Susan, you are so busy. Thank you for taking time to spend with our listeners.
Well, thanks for calling attention to this topic.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.